Hi, this is Paul, and some of you might recognize Tim. He's been on the channel before. Tim recently wrote a piece that Barry Weiss put on her Substack, and it's called A Secular Case for Christianity. A community of believers and non-believers lays the groundwork for America's next great awakening. And Tim told his story in the last conversation, and I'll put a link to it below so you can find it. And that's where my usual first conversation, he goes into his story. So Tim, why don't you tell me where this piece, now unfortunately it's on Barry Weiss's Substack, but it's a paid article. And this for me is part of the flaw of Substack, because I'm subscribed to about two or three dozen Substacks, but I can't pay $5 a month for every single one of them. So yeah. I'm still waiting for Substack to develop its all you can eat membership, where, you know, maybe like Google Premium, YouTube Premium, they'll give a piece to who, you know, whatever.
No, I like your idea. I'd be surprised if they aren't considering something like that. Yeah. They have to be. Because I will say, if anybody's curious about it, just find me on Twitter, DM me at your email, and I'll just send you the full piece. So, happy to do that.
Well, I thought the piece was very, very telling of everything that's going on in this little corner of the internet, downstream from Jordan Peterson. It's consistent with what I hear and hear and see on Twitter and in a lot of different places, where people know they need, basically in modernity and secularity, it said religion is an optional thing. And so that defined religion a certain way, and you can be fine without it. Part of the difficulty is that I'm thinking about the Peugeot Weinstein conversation. You is also a lineage, mm-hmm. and you might go a generation or two without a lot, but you is a lineage. You're not only go horizontally, you go vertically, and religion is kind of important. So why don't you kind of walk us through your argument, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, I mean, I was just reflecting on, like, why is the meaning crisis? Why is this community, you know, if there was a period of time there, Paul, where I was watching every single one of your videos, you know, and that probably wasn't sustainable, but in watching several other folks as well. And, you know, it just seems to me that what's so valuable and unique about what's happening is the frame translation thing, right? People are earnestly, like, trying to listen to each other and translate across those frames. And I think that's happening at many different levels, right? And there are many different types of frames. There are many different types of frames in the within the secular modern world. But the biggest one, I think, is the Christian versus non-Christian. And so, you know, I've been operating kind of in the margins of that since even before I happened upon Jordan, you know, because of my marriage and because I was open to it in certain ways pretty early on. I've been operating in those margins, and I wanted to capture that. And I wanted, you know, the story I tell at the beginning of the Paschal greeting, right, where I'm a secular person, but I've been operating in these Christian environments, right? And where someone says to me, "He is risen," and I, you know, and what they expect me to say back is, "He is risen indeed," or "Alleluia, he is risen." And I don't know that. I wanted to capture that moment because it seems to me that that's the type of moment that you fear as a secular person, right? Or maybe you fear as any person entering in a new community, right? This moment of the password and what am I going to say? And to be honest, Paul, I was working on that piece when you and I chatted a while ago. That piece started, I wanted to write a piece about Christianity, like, let's get rid of the statement of faith. That might be a bit strong. That wasn't what I was really saying, but I wanted to go at the statement of faith and say, maybe Christianity shouldn't be so propositional, right? And look at this Paschal greeting. It encapsulates how we think about who is a Christian versus who is not, right? Who is willing to say he is risen? And frankly, I think watching you and listening to you talk to lots of different people, I started to be less confident that getting rid of the statement of faith was a good idea, or that de-emphasizing it was a good idea. And so anyway, I wanted to capture that. And then I also wanted to talk about the thinkers that have helped me as a secular person, do some of that frame translation, right? And so the thinkers I talk about in the latter half of the piece that's behind the paywall, are René Girard, Tom Holland, who I got from you, and Jordan Peterson, in the sense that Girard is sort of making an attempt to knit together like the Christian view of the world with the secular study of anthropology, right? And I don't want to make an idol out of Girard. Sometimes I read Girard and I'm like, or people related to him, and I'm not even sure I understand exactly what they're saying, but I appreciate some of the insights that he's thinking about the question of how Christianity has worked in the world from an anthropological standpoint. That's very interesting, right? Whether you agree with him or not. And I think Holland is doing the same thing in history, right? He's translating between the Christian worldview and the secular worldview, and saying how has Christianity impacted the world? And then I think Peterson is, doing the same at the psychology level, knitting together, right, like cognitive science and evolutionary psychology and his clinical practice with Christianity. And those have been very helpful to me. And I got some feedback, from friends. My former pastor actually emailed me after he read the piece. He said, really interesting, but I don't think we should be focusing as Christians on what works, right? That's what's wrong with modern Christianity. We're focused too much on what works. And that, I was like, oh, that's interesting, because that's a frame I don't have, right? And I'd be curious to hear your point of view on that. Like, what does he mean when he says that? What do you think he means when he says that?
Well, there's the old joke where someone, and this is kind of big in certain Dutch philosophical circles. Well, that might work in practice, but it'll never work in theory. Okay. That we ought not to be too dismissive of what works, given that it works, and working is probably a sign of something. You look at many of the major, right now, all over Twitter, the anticipated takedown of Roe v. Wade, let's say. Mm-hmm. And okay. I think abortion is an evil thing. I do not think the unborn should be killed. So, however, people find themselves, that's a little passive. People get themselves pregnant mm-hmm. with other people. And that's something that is going to need to be worked out. And I think abortion, part of the evil of abortion is in fact its expediency. Mm-hmm. But the other path, which is less expedient, is also going to have to be worked. And I have the same issues with same-sex marriage. You have people who are, who are clearly attracted to the same sex, and So the church's response to same-sex attraction is going to have to be practical, because people are going to have to walk down that road. Now, there's always the tension between the antithesis and sort of the pragmatic. And the antithesis says no. And you have to always allow the no, but you always have to allow the pragmatic. Someone is going to have to walk that path every day, whether it's an undesired pregnancy or an undesired sexual attraction. That is something in their life they are going to have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And in terms of from a pastoral perspective, it's usually those hard paths that are the paths in which faith is grown and the kinds of transformations that we need as human beings to become remarkable, powerful, mature. It's those kinds of paths that usually create those kinds of transformations. So on one hand, we should have a degree of skepticism about the pragmatic, because the antithesis is always with us.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
On the other hand, so is the pragmatic. And so much of life is the tension between those two things. And, expedience is in that way sort of the sin of surrender to the pragmatic, which says, I don't care about the antithetical, I'm going to do what's expedient. But expedience seldom creates great people.
Yeah. Well, and ugly things are like the way we argue these things is, look at this ugly thing that's going to happen if we go this route. Well, abortion's a great example. Ugly things are going to happen no matter which route you go, right? And, you know, there's no way around it, right? If it's legal, there's going to be certain ugliness. And if it's illegal, there's going to be another set of ugliness. And if you take a side and you purely think of it as like, I have to win this argument, then you blind yourself to all the ugliness, and you willfully blind yourself to the ugliness that follows out of what you've been advocating for. And you aren't willing to open your eyes to be fully present to see that, I think.
And the church has been guilty of that.
Yes. Yes.
And that has been a problem for Christianity and for any religion, really, but for or any normative system. And the church, so the church has to learn to walk with people through ugly, mm-hmm. difficult things.
Well, not only that, individual people need to be willing to walk with other people through really difficult, ugly right. things, right? I agree.
Part of what we're dealing with is that people. So change. We've been living in a context of very rapid change, and. The conversation I just posted with Joey and Mark and Father Eric, I thought
the atheists.
Yes.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
I thought that was terrific, because what I saw in that conversation was that the clergy, like Father Eric and myself, we tend to major on the grand narrative. And we tend to major on the grand narrative and using the grand narrative to help deliver meaning to people. But if you listen to Joey and Mark, they're very much coming at it from the bottom. Mm-hmm. And Joey was in some ways making a secular case for church in that mm-hmm. video, saying, I need people around me. I need to have an obligation. I need to have a job. If I don't have a mission, if I'm not useful, I am a child and I will never mature. And so I don't turn up my nose at a secular case for Christianity, because I think even ideally with respect to the grand narrative in Christian theology, the Christ came because of our need. And what you find, I think, if you read the Gospels, is Jesus often operating with these two things. So, for example, when the sinful woman, crashes the party at the home of the Pharisees, Jesus was attending the party with the Pharisees. So not only does he eat with sinners, he also eats with Pharisees. Mm-hmm. And he attends the party with the Pharisees, and they don't offer him the expected hospitality of foot washing. Mm-hmm. So this woman, this sinful woman from the village, I'm sure everybody understood her sin, crashes the party with her tears. she washes his feet, and then she lets down her hair, which is, you know, if nobody understood the kind of woman this was, just her letting down her hair in that culture said a lot. Mm-hmm. And she dries his feet with her hair. Now, there's lots of layers to symbolism with this. And then, of course, the Pharisees at the party take offense. If Jesus knew the kind of woman that this was, and then he turns it around on them and says, you know, those who sin much love much. And I think from there it's our need that propels us to Christ. And I know a lot of people who can't do it right, but do as best they can. Mm-hmm. And throughout scripture, so even Naaman in Kings, who, you know, finally washes in the Jordan, is cleansed from his leprosy, but he's a general. He's accountable to the king, and he knows he has to go back to Syria, and he needs to bow at the altar of a pagan god, because that's basically what it is with a little narrative. And so he's asked Elisha, what am I going to do? I want some earth to take back so I can have an altar and worship your God. But, you know, so he's going to stay a polytheist.
Right.
But when I'm with my master and I go to the temple and I have to bow my knee to support him to bowing his knee, will I offend your God? And Elisha says, go in peace. It's like, wow, you're setting aside, you know, the exclusivity of Israel's God for the political expedience of a tyrant, and you being the chief general hatchet man for that tyrant. This is a God who flexes, and that's part of the story, but you need both.
Yep. Yep. It's really complicated. And I was struck in that conversation with the two atheists, right? I think they were expressing something that I feel sometimes, or I have felt. Sometimes it seems to me like people of the church, priests, ministers, pastors, are kind of waiting for each person to have that road to Damascus moment, right? In fact, one of the comments that I remember best about my last session with you was somebody said, this man needs a road to Damascus moment, right? And I think, fair enough, that's one path, right? But as I, in this exchange with my former pastor, I was like, you know, we're in a culture where many people are bringing to this the idea that Christianity is a bigoted religion of baseless superstition that has been used to oppress people. And I think one of the things that Jordan Peterson did so effectively was that he pierced that. And once you pierce that, then you start to wonder, well, if it's not as much garbage as I thought it was, then why the heck aren't I going to church? Right? Like, I don't know whether, you know, the truth of it, you may be like, that was the other thing I tried to do with the piece. Like, you know, sometimes I grew up Catholic and doubt was talked about, right? But there was sort of talked about like this needle, like you were, you know, usually you're at faith and then occasionally you flip to doubt and then you flip back to faith. I think that's not how people work. And, you know, I think there are parts of believers' minds, I'm guessing there are parts of non-believers' minds who completely believe, as I have. There are parts of, and I'm not even sure I'm a non-believer, right? I mean, I don't know what I am. I honestly don't know what I am, and I'm sort of in the midst of that journey, and I'm fine with it. But I think, you know, we have different parts of our brain that are saying different things to us at any given time, and we internally flip frames. Like, we all have our preferred frames, but we internally flip between these frames. I just think that having a theory about how Christianity works in the world, both on individual people, but both and for society, like, that's okay. I actually think that it's a moral imperative. And I think it's a moral imperative for both believers and non-believers, because, you know, if you're a believer, you have to admit that people have done awful things in the name of their faith, things that you probably would be horrified. And so I think any believer has to have, whether it's simple or complicated, and whether it's based on intellectuals or whether it's based on their intuition, you've got an idea in your head of how the Christian faith works for good, both within you and within other people. But you almost have to have an idea that sometimes this doesn't work out so well, right?
Yeah.
But I think non-believers face the mirror image problem, which is, okay, if you're a secular woke person and you're a fan of, you know, not having slavery, well, then how can you look at the past and say, well, why were Christian people so involved in that? Right? Where did that come from?
Yeah.
And yeah. They don't want to talk about that. They don't want to, you know, and just like believers don't want to necessarily talk about, you know, heretics being burned at the stake. Right.
Right.
And so anyway, I think everyone is doing that to some degree, if they're being intellectually honest and if they're being open and they're not just trying to win an argument. Right. And I think it's okay for believers to have some intellectual firepower behind them and saying, hey, this has worked out pretty well, right, in many ways. Right. And that's not to say that captures all of the mystery. Like my former pastor, he's like, that gets rid of the mystery and the beauty. I'm like, I'm not sure it does. I think we can talk about how things work without saying that exhausts the mystery. Like, Gerard doesn't explain Christianity, all of Christianity. I think the fear with Gerard, I think the danger with Gerard is that he sort of offers a theory of everything.
Yeah.
And you got to be a little careful with that, I think. Anyway, I'm still fascinated by his ideas. Anyway, I'm riffing a little bit.
Well, no, that's good. That's kind of what you're here for.
Yeah.
But part of the difficulty of churches is obviously also the disappointment. The disappointment of what should be ultimate things.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to stay away from church because you'll know you'll be disappointed. It's another thing to commit to a community, even though you know you'll be hurt. And for almost everything, for so many things in life, that's just a function of this age. I mean, Amber Heard and Johnny Depp are, you know, I haven't watched much of it lately, but I'm sort of fascinated by this train wreck, this public train wreck
mm-hmm.
that is going on, that is captivating a lot of people. And it's important to remember that this train wreck begins with two people declaring their undying love for one another, and they somehow saw in each other the answer to all of their problems. I mean, that's sort of what the first stages of infatuated love is. You look at this person and, you know, we've got
yep.
thousands of songs about it. And now they are both giving public testimony to that absolutely destroys each other's reputations. And you have unbelievable amounts of dirty laundry that are coming out. And now, thank the Lord that not everybody's marriage is filled with defecating in beds and angry tirades and, a drug and alcohol abuse and all of these things. But many marriages have plenty of those elements anyway.
Or other forms of ugliness.
Or right? other forms of ugliness.
Yep.
And yet, so then people, you know, currently people are like, well, then why marry? Oh, did you think you could avoid the ugliness by avoiding marriage?
Yeah. Well, no, it's a very good analogy, because when you said that about the church, it just reminded me, like, I struggled so much to get into a healthy, committed relationship, and I desperately wanted to be a dad and a husband, and I struggled. And I think I was struggling because I was getting into relationships where I idealized the other person, where I idealized them into something that filled some deep insecurity in me. that I was hoping that they would kind of, that being with them would kind of fill that hole. And, you know, when I got into a relationship, it was about, okay, like, is this a vehicle that's going to work for me to be a contribute to something bigger than myself, right? And like, does this work? Is this person going to be better with me? Am I going to be better with them? Are we going to be better in the community together? And that just turned out to be a way better, you know, and it is, it's, you know, at times it's very prosaic and it's, we have our frustrations and it's, you know, it's like the person that I was looking for these thrilling experiences with women. And I'm not talking about sexual experiences, but just like, just very invigorating, infatuating experiences, you know, that's not what a marriage is like. And so it's constantly, you know, you're constantly in a state of disappointment, right? And I'm sure Simone would have her own, you know, she's constantly in a state of disappointment, and I'm sure, but that, but it, in some fundamental way, it's working, right, for the good of both of us. And the community, I think, at least feels like it is.
Well, and yet in the marriage, you also don't completely give up on the ultimate.
Yeah.
Because you could look at each other and say, well, you know, this, yeah, you know, we're getting old and, you know, this marriage certainly hasn't met my expectations.
No, but yeah.
I guess
yeah.
You're the best I could get. Ugh, you don't yeah. talk that way in a marriage. At least if you start doing it, you'll probably not be married too much longer. Even yeah. though both parties completely understand that there's a world of just making one of the coffee break leader came in today. And what phrase did she said? I'm trying to stay married day today.
Right.
And what she means by that is I'm trying not to kill my husband today. And, yeah. And you know, and it's, if you're married, you know, this is part of a marriage is you compromise and you work it out. And there are settlements that you make that violate all sorts, especially if you're an idealist, all sorts of cherished ideals that you've had.
Yeah.
So they've got that right. But on the other hand, you also still have to, in a sense, participate in worship. You say, what does that mean? It means, in a sense, in an appropriate way, you have to worship, meaning give attention to your spouse. And that
and
is
to the relation and to the relationship as a separate entity unto itself. And
that's
and,
right.
And you have to have this star guiding you, like this thing above you. I agree. Yeah.
So I'm curious, you know, you could have, there's lots of ways to put out a document on the internet, but you, so Barry Weiss is, you know, well known in this little corner of the internet. She's a lesbian. She's a lesbian Jewish woman, and she somehow takes for her blog this guy who makes a secular case for Christianity. What's that about?
Well, I think it's about a few things. I mean, I wanted that piece to reach a secular audience, right? I had sort of written it for a secular audience. But I wanted to capture in the piece sort of this uncertainty about whether I am a believer or not, okay. Partially because I wanted both believers and non-believers to read it and to feel reassured and discomforted at the same time. Like I wanted them to have some of the similar experience, but I wanted to find a secular audience. So it got, I submitted to The Atlantic. I submitted to Quillette, both turned it down. And Barry, very graciously, I mean, Barry's a practicing Jew. She paired it, right? It had come out about the same time as this Exodus podcast that you would like. She's, I don't know if you've heard it. She's talking to a rabbi about the importance of the story of Exodus in our country's history. And so she talks about how two of the founders, or he talks about how two of the founders wanted to put a depiction of the Exodus story on the Great Seal of the United States, but they were not the hardcore believing Christians in the group. I think it might've been like Franklin and Jefferson, right? So they, this story, and you know, I think one of the things points I was trying to make to the secular folks is these stories are tremendously valuable, right? As a means of working out meaning, whether you believe them or not, right? Like, and you know, that Exodus story, like, I mean, he traces how it was important to the founding, but also how important it was to the end of slavery, the Civil War era, and the Civil Rights era, right? And so it paired very well, right? And Barry, you know, she's a practicing Jew. And I you know, anyway, I was in the midst, if Barry didn't accept it, I was in the midst of revising it to potentially submit it to something like First Things, right? But it would have been, I was gonna like, you know, it would have changed. It would have changed it. But Barry's in the middle of it, right? She's in the middle of the frame translation thing too. She's more on the politics culture war end. But I think if you pay attention to Barry, right, she's got, I think, bigger things going on as well. That's not her only thing. So yeah, anyway.
Well, I think, you know, I think that very much gets at the moment that we are in this culture. You know, John Vervaeke's conversation with, oh, I forget his name now, the chess player, the grandmaster on Rebel Wisdom.
I missed that one. Yeah.
Oh, you should definitely see it. I think it is the best conversation with John Vervaeke on the internet. And I've had some good ones, but I thought that one was, because John was so transparent, and so John has been so much that way in, mm-hmm. you know, on YouTube. He was so transparent and talking about his relationship with his son and his son's exploration of Christianity. And obviously mm-hmm. on the, you know, Bridges of Meaning Discord server, and in the emails that I get from people on Twitter, there are so many people that are in this space right now where, you know, they want to believe, they basically they want to be swept off their feet by a God. They really do. And they want more than that.
Right. They want to refind the community that somehow got lost, right, as the churches kind of declined.
Right.
They want so much, but yes. Yeah.
Well, that's the beginning. They want to be swept off their feet, and then they want happily ever after. They want the marriage, they want the white picket fence. I mean, they want that which is lost. And you know, I also think of Christopher Mastropietro's comment on my conversation with him, where he just sees Christianity as this receding sun, mm-hmm. and you know, this longing and this lament for something that is past, and there's almost the sense of I can't believe in falling in love anymore, but I also can't live without it. And right there in that tension. And so, you know, I was interested in the end of Glenn Lowry's conversation with Sam Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Harris basically lays out, We need an atheist church. And that didn't come out too long after my conversation on Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But the guy who has an atheist church, and he says, this should be our moment. And the Sunday celebrations and all of this, you know, atheist community stuff. And Comte, this has been tried since the 19th century, and Comte, and you know, the founder of sociology in some sense is sort of a secular replacement for, mm-hmm. you know, the community of Christianity and understanding it, creating a science and then applying the science. I mean, none of that has worked. And so I listened to Sam Harris, of all people, you know, wanting to, we just have to do this without all the supernatural. And I think, yeah, You just go ahead and tell your wife, honey, I want a marriage, but let's not do any of the romance. You know, let's not get head over heels with each other. Let's just settle down for a pragmatic solution.
Let's not tell the story about how we met. Right.
Yes.
let's give that up. Like, forget it. We don't need that. We already met. We know we already met. We know each other now. We can just be together. One of the unstated themes of the piece was just this sense of, it just feels like there was a failure of cultural transmission in around my generation. You know, I was born in 70. There's been, and like my lack of knowledge of the Paschal greeting, like I grew up in Catholic schools, so I have a cursory knowledge of the Bible stories, but really it's not as good as it should be. And if you want a society to function well, like I should know more. There was part of the piece where I talk about my secular education. So I was an English major at a very elite secular institution. And my sister went through that same program 8 years after me. And she said something to me. She was visiting LA. And she said to me, what I didn't like about being an English major at Pomona was that you didn't have to know anything, right? You were supposed to read these books. It was sort of the new criticism school where you read the text and the text has everything within it that you need to critique it. And there's some wisdom in that approach. It causes you to look at the text closely. It causes you to base your arguments in what's in the text, blah, blah, blah. But we didn't need to know anything to graduate from college, from an elite college.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear your perspective on what, I mean, I really want to read that Marston book that you keep talking about.
Oh, that's exactly where I'm going.
Yeah.
So I've been talking with Cale Zeldin about this.
Yeah.
See if I have Marston's book right here. So Marston wrote a book about basically the secular university and actually there's a more academic book that you can find, The Secularization of the Academy. And one of the points that Marston makes was, well, I'll back up a little bit. When I was reading a C.S. Lewis biography, Lewis, of course, you know, survived the First World War. Oxford was, you know, totally a military camp during the First World War. After the war, Oxford had to sort of get up and running again. And a brand new department at Oxford was English. And I thought, what does it mean that the English department came to Oxford in the 20th century?
Where were they reading Shakespeare before?
Exactly. Yeah. and, you know, basically what I picked up from Marston was that, you know, the classical liberal arts degree in many ways, because of what had happened in, you know, American universities, became the replacement of theology. The humanities were the replacement of theology.
But why did they think they needed to do that? Is my question. Like what? Why? Like what forces in the university were making the university think that they needed to dethrone theology?
What was happening? So first of all, these were, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton. Yeah. These were all Protestant theological schools that initially were founded for the training of clergy.
Mm-hmm.
And science really comes along and begins to threaten and start to undo, along with constant Protestant confessional battles.
Mm.
And so what happens, I mean, these universities are just, I mean, what's so funny about the current cancel culture and wokeism and all of that, as someone who has for generations been within a church, I look at that, it's like, you know, what is canceling but a heresy trial? I've lived in that environment all my life. There are always heresy trials. You're always getting canceled and it's always over theology. And so what you see in Marston's book is that you see that there's this evolution of the university. And so you have the problem of pluralism. So who's right, Harvard or Yale?
Right.
And now we get to the point where Curtis Yarvin basically makes a comment, why are Harvard and Yale on the same page? That's an achievement that they sought because we wanted to get rid of pervasive interpretive pluralism. And so Harvard and Yale could be on the same page. So now you have a different hegemony, but the cost of doing that was basically the confessional pluralism that Protestants just kept eating each other over in terms of theology. And so knowledge of the world, you know, and to a certain degree, science became, this is the way we can know the world. I mean, if you watch the evolution, you see that it takes a very long time. And you know, we're just living these little 80, 60, 80, 100 year lives in between, but it takes a very long time. And if you understand that whole arc, and then you see Jordan Peterson, when and why he arose and why we're at this moment right here, it's like, well, this makes perfect sense because, yeah, you can learn a lot about the world with science, but not at the scale that we actually need for ourselves and a civilization.
Well, and it might have some insights for you, but it's completely non-normative, right? And we are completely normative creatures. Like, we live in a normative universe. And I don't, but the other thing to keep in mind there, though, is that, you know, in my institution, like, the humanities people in my institution are not science people, right? Like, I was told, like, I have a friend who went on to become a professor at Brown of history. And we were on a train trip through Europe, and I was really going through this cognitive science, evolutionary psychology phase. And I had an answer to everything, and I was probably really annoying. And she was just like, leave my discipline alone, right? Like, you, and science, the scientists thought that the biggest bee in the hive was a male, right? And that they're bigoted, right? They're wrong. Science is a function of the culture that it's in. And I'm sitting on top of, like, I'm above that, right? They don't like science at all. Like, the English majors, right, in my school, like, there's a huge discomfort with science, right? So I don't fully understand the dynamics of how all that played out. I also wonder, Paul, I know a little bit about the history of the K-12 schools. I mean, the K-12 schools were Protestant institutions for decades. And at some point, you know, there was a nervousness about Catholic schools, and a lot of the states passed Blaine Amendments, right? Saying that public money couldn't go to sectarian schools.
Right.
Money was still going to the public schools, and they were still teaching Christianity in those schools. Yeah. But at a certain point, the courts came in and said, no, 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 no. And they took it all out. I don't know. I'm just,
well,
I'm
they, seeing. They, this is where you get to the definition of religion.
Right.
You need that definition if you're going to function in this way, because you need, okay, so you can't pray in public. So
yeah. Going to excise? Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're at the moment now where we're realizing that, well, representation. How are we going to represent a family? And what does that look like?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And what is a family? I mean, in the 70s, the big debate was about divorce functionally. A family doesn't mean a dad and a mom and kids. A family can have only a mom, or maybe, you know, the Brady Bunch was this, you know, here you had it, dad and mom, and it's like widows, divorce. They just evaporated. And the children, you know, never once do we see Bobby or Cindy say, I miss mom. Oh, no, no, she's right here. No, I miss my real mom. You know, never once does Bobby say this.
I've never thought that, never even crossed my mind. I'm seeing that show in a whole new way.
You know, so.
But how do you have a school? Right. How do you teach, how do you form young children without some sort of transcendent, I don't think you do. Like, I think you make an argument that it's there, whether you like it or not. You can excise whatever you want, but something's going to slide into that vacuum. Right. And anyway, I can just see my daughter, you know, I told you in our last conversation, my daughter's in this, you know, little Orthodox Catholic school. And I can just see how the catechesis is like, it's embedded in the instruction, and it's working, right? Like she's just comes home from school alive with this stuff. It's amazing. It's amazing to see.
Well, and this is what, you know, so the Dutch immigrants who founded my institutions, this is what they, you know, Christian day school, Christian college. I mean, we were practicing the Benedict option long before Rod Dreher was born.
Right, right.
But at some point, you have to deal with the pluralism of the world. And so for most of CRC history, we drew our identity by being sort of anti-Catholic. Mm-hmm. And you could fit in America because in many ways, America was the great Protestant homeland. Mm-hmm. And there were all these implicit agreements that built America. And again, it's in the middle of the 20th century when FDR, you know, I've been listening to the Weinstein-Peugeot conversation, and Brett Weinstein basically says, yeah, but Judeo-Christian, it's like, pause. You're not going to find that phrase before FDR in the mid 20th century. And right at the heels of the Second World War was this critical piece, Protestant, Catholic, Jew. Okay, so we're going to have to bind these three communities together.
Mm. Yep.
But very quickly, you've got a lot of other things going on. And so now we're to the point that we're realizing just how we want, people are like, well, human beings are enormously socially programmable. Yeah, but that doesn't mean all the programs will lead to good or the same ends. And, right. And again, this is what really sets up the Jordan Peterson moment, because he sort of turns a light on the fact that, hey, wait a minute. Do you know how much stuff is built into our assumptions? And not only just sort of the assumptions that someone can point out quickly to you, but the cognitive science, all of these values are built into your pre-conscious awareness so that this is shaping the way you look. In other words, the value system through which you judge the world is, in Brett Weinstein's terms, already a lineage.
And you didn't choose it.
No, you did not choose
the frame through which you're seeing the world. I mean, all my years studying cognitive science, you know, I almost went to MIT to get a PhD. And like, the biggest thing that came out of it was, holy crap, my brain is doing all sorts of stuff that I am completely unaware of. And so I should be extremely humble, right? Because I'm only aware of a very small fraction of the ways in which my brain is processing the world. You gotta be very careful. How did your kids go to CRC schools? Like, I don't know if you want to talk about your kids, but like the formation of your kids, like they're probably a little younger than me. But
we homeschooled.
Anyway, they were homeschooled. Yeah.
We homeschooled.
Yep.
So, but then they went to public school.
Yep.
And
well, that has to happen. As you said, like you can't completely Benedictize, right? I mean, or let me say it this way. I'm not sure that would be a good idea, right? Like there has to be both.
Well, you just sort of forestall the shock.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, we're looking at, I mean, not only are, I mean, you just articulated it with respect to, well, my brain. Well, you know, the truth is, and this is where I think Jordan Peterson's Jungian influence was quite powerful. And just to, you know, for those who are allergic to Jung, you can read Alan Jacobs on a bunch of this stuff, who is by no means a Jungian. None of us think alone. Mm-hmm. Human beings have a weird sort of hive mind. And because we're so amazingly programmable, you know, I know this, you know, this could get me kicked off Twitter or YouTube or something, but the current, I can't help but understand the current rash of gender dysphoria at numbers, you know, at numbers that are just exponentially larger than they were 30 years ago, is because we are really pliable creatures. But sure. But so on one hand, we're way more pliable than we thought we were. On the other hand, part of us, especially when it comes to lineage and scale, we're way less, which means it's really fragile.
Well, and I want to, you said you put off the shock by, you know, doing homeschooling or something like some sort of, I think there's more to it than that, because I think there's this really useful idea in cognitive science called the critical period, right? So if you, there's a famous example of a girl who was kept in a closet, abused, and she was not exposed to language until she was freed from her parents' clutches when she was like 12 or 13. And I worked with the woman at UCLA, this linguist who worked with her to try and teach her language. Yeah. This was a cognitively normal girl. Yeah. She was smart, but she couldn't learn language. And there has to be, there are many examples of that, like picking up an instrument, but think about, like, if you think about moral formation, right? And the formation of how you think about the universe and the cosmos and your relationship to it, there has to be a critical period, right? Where if you, like, it's fixed in some sense, once you get to age 10 or 11, I don't even know what it is. I mean, that's actually a fascinating idea for somebody to look at that. Like, how early can you form someone in their fundamental assumptions about morality and where the world came from and where it's going? There's got to be a critical period, right? Like, yeah. It, yeah. Anyway.
Well, and so, you know, I've had a couple conversations, one with a, and I'll see if he listens to this. He teaches at a local community college, and he said, since students are back in the classroom, he says, I've checked notes with my colleagues. Students sort of look at you blank faced and you call on them and they keep looking at you. Mm. And it's like, did in that 2 years of having university on Zoom, did people learn or unlearn, or did something happen? And my wife, she teaches at a public school. My wife just said to me yesterday too, she said, you know, I'm again, now all the masks are off finally in Sacramento. And so the children are seeing our faces and we're seeing their faces. And so a child, it was a third grader from another class. And she's trying to get to know as many of the kids' names in school as she can. Child walked by her and she said, you know, she turned, looked, eye contact, hello, saying the child's name. And the child, this is a second or third grader, child mm-hmm. said hello, never made eye contact, kept walking by. Now you might expect this in a junior high student, or, you know, but that young, you very quickly begin to say, we are playing with things, with these screens, with in all sorts of ways. We are playing with things now that we have no idea what the consequences are going to be. And especially if you understand that with any given individual, there's sort of a window mm-hmm. for development.
Yep. Yeah. The critical period. Yeah. The window. Yep.
It's like, oh, there is going to be a lot of suffering coming down the pike.
I think there are going to be some angry children. You know, yes. I mean, one reason I have my kid in the school, I mean, there are many, many reasons I have my kid in the school, no devices, right? Because yeah. I saw what was happening and I was like, that's not appropriate. I don't want that happening, you know?
Yep.
And that, you know, the device, I mean, devices are allowing us to do this. There's so much wonderful that has come out of the devices and you know, I agree. It's hard to see how it's going to shake out. And it I think we're all going to have to adjust. Like the culture will adjust, I think, and put in boundaries. I don't know if that means there's some Luddite thing coming or I don't know. I think the culture will adjust, but it's going to be a bumpy road.
Yeah. And there'll be a lot of suffering. And, you know, you think about the Romanian case where they had these orphanages of, you know, this whole generation, a massive number of children in orphanages. And again, some of these longitudinal studies on some of these individuals, it's like, wow. So I don't want this to get too depressing, but again, it comes back to the title of your piece, you know, A Secular Case for Christianity, in terms of, and that's not just Christianity. It also has to do with sort of deep traditions that have sustained humanity. And whereas on one hand with, you know, with wokeism and many other movements too, it's not just wokeism. The realization of that says, yeah, you know, hey, racism isn't just, you know, an obvious, overt, instinctive reaction to someone of a different race. Racism is a far more complex and nuanced thing.
It's a cultural phenomenon that has some of that, what you just described. You're right. Yep.
And so if you want to undo it, but part of the issue is the undoing of a lot of things is also what we try to react from, you know, previous generations about. Why are, you know, I don't want to out this person, but I know someone who has his own private stash of DDT, and he's an older guy. And he said to me, because we had a little something, he said, well, I'll bring over some DDT. And it's like, DDT. And he said, yeah, you know, nothing really does quite as good as that DDT. And it's like,
oh my goodness.
Well, maybe if just one individual is just sprinkling it here. I mean, it's kind of like lead paint. I worked in a lumber yard with a hardware store, and some of the old time painters would say, you know, nothing really kind of adheres as well as that lead paint. Like, there's a reason they had lead in it in the first place.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know. I think you have to be careful which ideas you attach yourself to. And I used to be such a secular modern person. Just like, I can figure this out. My brain can figure this out and we can move on. And I'm just finding myself, just really wondering about this cultural heritage that just seems to have, it's not gone, right? But there was a failure of transmission. And I don't fully understand that failure of transmission. And I actually, it's fascinating. My mom told me, I was talking about my newfound interest in theology and philosophy. And I was like, in history. And I sort of ignored those things. And I said that at the dinner table. My mom said, well, that's fascinating, because one of the priests at your Jesuit school came to you during high school and said, you know, I'd like Tim to start reading like Augustine and Aquinas. And I supposedly, I don't remember this incident. I said, no. Why did I say no to that? What made me think I could say no to that? Why was that not appealing? Probably fed into some of my own shortcomings at the time.
Well, and I think, so this is where, at this moment of the conversation, I reveal myself to be exactly what I am and what everyone knows me to be, which is a Protestant.
Yeah.
Because even the church is always changing and experimenting. And the, let's say, a rejuvenated Catholic Church of 2030 will be very different from the Catholic Church of 1930.
Of course.
And part of what I hope to at least have a small part in facilitating is in fact the trying to find spaces, you know, I think about this estuary project I'm working on, conversations where, you know, people can, because there's some people that are able to say, all right, I'm gonna go to church. And very, very quickly, it's like, that's just the beginning, you know, walking in the door, because you're going to have to, there's going to be a dance of giving yourself, but there's also going to be negotiation.
And when you, as you described in that other video, like it's an intimate thing, right? Like how a person engages with a community, like you have to figure out that fit. Yeah.
And like any marriage, you know, suddenly we're just commenting about it. The woman in Coffee Break that said, yeah, I'm having one of these, you know, trying to stay married days. And she said, cause her mother was there with her. And she said, you know, dad, meaning, you know, her father, you know, dad was an electrician. And so when anything would break in the house, you know, dad would fix it. But her husband is, you know, one of these, you know, brain workers, works for the state like all of us and, you know, doesn't fix anything in the house. And so there's this, and so this is going to impact the church. And we have no idea how this all works out, because the only way to pursue it is to actually try it. And then the church doesn't know how to, I mean, that's what I struggle with now. The church doesn't know how to receive, and, you know, because these people have to be, there needs to be catechesis in terms of formation and teaching, sure. But
nobody, I heard that concern in the atheist thing, like nobody's going to accept me if I'm not, you know, converting to Catholicism. Well, I don't know. I was a secular person in church for a long time, right? And nobody kicked me out. And let me say that the number of religious people who have reached out to me to have conversations after that piece I published is higher. And I experienced a higher degree of openness, right? Then I'll bet many of my secular friends rolled their eyes when they saw that and said, Tim's fallen for that BS, right? Nobody kicked me out of church. Nobody said no if I wanted to. No one, I don't know. I think it's less of a concern. I'm doing it in two communities. You know, we have an Anglican church, a small Anglican church plant that we go to. And then I'm also trying to engage with my kids' school and trying to figure out that dance of how I can contribute and feel comfortable and feel like I'm giving, like I'm, you know, yeah, but that it's useful to them, and that it's, you know, giving me whatever I need out of that, right? To feel wanted and useful. Anyway, I'm trying to figure that out. I think it's very important to me, because if this is just conversations online, it was the whole thing, like the Wellman conversation, right? Where he said, I'm kind of a monk. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I hate to hear that, because that guy, like, he just seems such an admirable person. Like, yeah. I was just like, yeah, this guy's so smart. He's, you know, his, yep, book's next on my list, and he seems so empathetic.
And he's honest.
Yeah. And he's honest. Like, don't be a monk. Like, don't be a monk. Like I want you, like, come to my church. Like, I want you, like, I just feel like we need people like that to be directly engaging in communities and not, anyway, I think I have that tendency. There's a little bit of a fear, like, you know, I'm going to start reading, you know, I've got the stack of books from your videos, from other people's videos, from friends recommending after they read my piece. And it just grows and grows and grows. And it's so rewarding, because I'm still exploring and I'm still trying to figure out where I am. But if I'm not more engaged with my kids' school, or if I'm still kind of halfway committed to church, and I don't think I'm going to feel good about that 20 years from now.
No, you're exactly right. And your point about most religious communities will love to have you. You can volunteer on many levels, but there are obviously within the religious communities, and this differs widely,
sure,
levels of availability, especially in terms of leadership, because they are trying to,
yes,
have continuation of a tradition. And, you know, personally, I've been such a, you know, because of the shape of my channel, because of where I, you know, stuck my beak in, I'm in such a brokerage position. I have, conversations online and offline about this. I had a wonderful conversation with a couple who, you know, they participate in a very conservative, traditional Christian community. And, you know, one that has, you know, restrictions on women wearing pants and makeup and these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
I had another conversation with a woman who, you know, politically very libertarian, let's mm-hmm. say, but sort of religiously quite open. And, you know, I have friends like that here too, who they're unvaccinated, not because they, you know, are going to storm the Capitol on January 6th. They're as blue as can be, but they're unvaccinated because we just believe in a much more natural approach to human
holistic health.
Exactly. Right. And people are all over the place. And this is where the pluralism gets so difficult. So, okay, how can we have religious communities that are crunchy enough to have meaning and value, but open, accessible, and flexible enough to meet people where they're at and help them along the way? And where on one hand, we understand that we are short-lived creatures, that there's going to be tremendous variability. On the other hand, to understand that there is a structure to the world, there is a created order, and that, you know, maybe it's not a good idea if you're not quite sure what sex you are before the age of 20, that you're going to have an awfully hard time trying to figure that out in your 20s and 30s, just because life is short. And yeah. So, I mean, and this on a scale, and I mean, there's so many issues like this right now.
And you're in the midst. I mean, it's sort of what you were talking about with Peugeot, right? Peugeot is he's interacting with all these different frames. And I think you're at least the one other person I know who's doing that, right? From a strong perspective, but still being very open to people from different frames. And it's a very useful function. But I agree, there's been such a proliferation, right, that it's hard to get the center to hold with a small community again. And that's both just in beliefs, right? It's confessional. It's also music. Yeah. The aesthetics, like, it's hard to find a church where you're going to feel comfortable with the sermon and the music, where you both are going to feel, that's hard just because there's been this explosion, combinatorial explosion. Like, it's just hard to find that. And the compromises that you have to make, because you can go on Spotify and you can listen to your favorite genre of music over and over, whatever makes you feel transcendent, you can listen to that over and over. And then you go to church and you no longer have the commonality of that music. And so it's falling, the average person, it's falling further and further short. But on the other hand, our church has great music, and there is something about being in a room with people together. You didn't pay to be there, and you're all singing the same song. Like, yeah, that, if you can get close enough, there is something very, very powerful there that you can't get from Spotify, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, it's participation. And I mean, music has been for Protestants, especially since English hymnody, and even though music for Protestants has in some ways been their miracle door.
Yeah.
And you see that in the mega churches, because mega churches, that's in, you know, church planting, what I, you know, did a lot of before, or participated in before, you know, all the YouTube stuff. Yeah. You dial in your church, you get your target audience basically by where they land musically.
Yeah.
And then you tune your sermons, you know, and, but, oh gosh, this stuff goes on and on, but no, you're exactly right. And the conversation with Tripp and Dr. Jim Wellman, you know, that was just heartbreaking, because here's a man longing for, you know, he says he goes to church and it just breaks his heart.
Mm.
And that's,
yeah, no, I remember that.
And he's talking about mainline churches. The mainline has in many ways tried to be as accommodating as humanly possible. And yet people go there and it's like, so there's gotta be a crunchy edge.
Yeah.
And so now it's that, you know, Lyle Scherler pointed this out, an early church growth guru 40, 50 years ago. He says, you know, it's always the, I'll rephrase it somewhat. It's always the churches with bite that grow.
Yeah.
There needs to be a bite on you. And so, you know, you have that with the Orthodox. And so on one hand, you know, people are like, I'm going to do a year of catechesis. And I'm going to get chrism. I may even need to get rebaptized. And I'm going to be standing up chanting all through Holy Week. And I'm going to, okay, those are the high end people. But I know lots of other people are like, well, I think the Orthodox Church is interesting. Do you ever go? Well, no, right. Because I can't, you know. And again, it's not unlike a marriage, but a marriage is only two people, but it's a two people with, you know, huge intimacy and contact. Churches have less intimacy and contact, so there's more room for negotiation, but it's tremendously complex.
Well, and you said something in a video, like that Christianity has both been a sect and a community. It's really interesting. It's just really interesting to think about that, because I grew up in Christianity as a community, right? A low level community, right? Like, we're all Catholic. We come to church, we show up, but it wasn't felt deeply. At least it didn't appear to be felt deeply by very many people. And, you know, the school that my daughter's going to, it feels more Dreyerian, right? Yeah. Or, you know, it feel like these are people who feel it and practice it. And like somebody mentioned in a poker game, the litany. And I was like, I grew up Catholic. I didn't know what the litany was. I had to look up what the litany was. And like, I'm finding myself drawn to that. On the other hand, like all of my instincts as a human being are, you know, have been away from that type of religion. And anyway, I don't know where that's going to end up. I don't, you know, my wife asked me last night, are you going to become a Catholic? I'm like, I don't know. Are you going to go back to Catholicism? I don't know. I don't know. It's possible.
Well, and that tension between a community. So one of the interesting things, if you look at, say, church history in Catholic countries in Europe, you have over time, you know, you have periods of intensification where, you know, often you'll have institution building after that and all that.
Yeah. So
built periods of intensification and then periods that get lax. And there was, before the French Revolution, there was a period of intense, you know, intensification around the Catholic Church. So then you had the French Revolution, which is this huge swing the other way. And so part of, on one hand, it's just like everything else. On one hand, you don't want pure homeostasis. You want big swings where you can have intensification, where you can build institutions and you can have revivals and you can have all this, but they tend to get overheated. And that, so then you have a lessening, but then you're missing some other things. And so,
the Catholic Church tries to slow that down, but you're right. Like what you said earlier, like clearly the Catholic Church, that happens within the Catholic Church. It happens. There's much more of that in Protestantism, right?
Yes.
Much more response to the current cultural conditions, much more flare-ups and die-outs. It's fascinating. I mean, it almost seems from where we're at that it was inevitable that it would end up like in this situation with like a bulwark form of Christianity and then forms of, you know, frothiness, right? And I don't want to mischaracterize. I mean, you know, not all forms of Protestantism are frothy, right? But there's
very frozen.
Yeah, no, right, exactly. But there's a lot of variation. It's inevitable, and all of it's constantly changing, right? And it's a mistake. I think Catholics can mistake the hierarchy and the orthodoxy and the you know, for the church, right? It's like, that's a piece of it. There's a lot going on Anyway,
that's part of the reason that there's plenty of Protestant scandals, mm-hmm. but if you have a scandal in the hierarchy because of the ecclesiology, that's way different for the Catholic Church than it is to say, well, there's Ravi Zechariah or there's some other,
It attaches to the whole brand. It attaches exactly. to the whole brand instead of just this one, Yeah.
Because if you have the priesthood of all believers, then, you're going to have some really crappy priests out there. But if your priests are in some ways the epitome of the faith.
Well, what do they call that? The apostolic succession.
Apostolic succession. That's right.
That word. Yeah. I'm learning all this stuff. I'd never heard of that before. But
and then suddenly you read sort, the life of certain medieval and Renaissance popes, and it's like,
yeah,
this is the succession of Christ. And now suddenly the invisible church that Luther postulates doesn't seem so. Because if that's the visible church, then I'd like to at least continue to live in the fantasy. So
no, right, and the invisible church has its own right, there's no safe haven, right? There's no safe haven. purity.
There really isn't. So you don't get to pick your times, you don't get to pick your culture. You don't get to pick the upbringing that you had. You don't get to pick what was given to you within these little developmental windows that you had.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You've got more choice than just about any, you've got more affluence and choice than just about any other generation in all of human society. What you gonna do?
Agreed. We are. Too much choice. Too much That's choice. Right. Anyway, yeah.
Any final thoughts about your piece and response to it? And
No. Like I said, I'd be happy to forward it to anybody. If you DM me, send me your email. I've got the full email version. And I'm just going to keep working through it. I felt really happy just to be able to put something down on paper that sort of captured where I was at. And anyway, I was very happy to just be able to contribute in some small way and try to capture where I'm at, because I'm going to be really fascinated to look back on that piece, 3 years, 5 years from now.
Yeah. What age range are your kids? You don't have to give their ages, but
7, 4, and we have a newborn.
Okay. Yeah. You're just at the beginning.
Well, it's good to bring it back to the kids, because I think, that's where the rubber meets the road, because if there is a critical period, there are these windows. And if I feel there's been this failure of cultural transmission, and I feel like I don't have as much of the cultural heritage in me as I want, then how do I cultivate that for my kids so that they have more of that, and they can reject it, right? They can reject it and they'll almost certainly take it in their own direction. But how does someone who feels like I feel half empty in that regard, and I'm learning about all this new stuff, how do I give them what I don't have, right? And it's partly the other adults I surround them with. It's partly where do I take myself in the next 10 years? But it's who I surround them with and what do we read and how do we spend our time? Anyway, it's just, it really brings it home, because I know a lot of my friends who got, they were exposed to kind of attenuated, weakened forms of Christianity. And they've sort of said, good riddance. I didn't need any of that.
Yeah.
And that path, I don't feel comfortable with that path. So I'm going to have to do some things that I feel a little uncomfortable with.
It's not new. I look at my parents, and of course they were raising us in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And, they had to deal with these questions. I think back to my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother. So he was sent over to America when he was 18, mm-hmm. to kind of set up for some of the rest of the family coming. And then he married a woman and she dies in childbirth with their sixth child. and he has to move from a more rural setting to a more urban setting, and he winds up marrying. So she had a brother, his wife who died had a brother who also died, and he was married to a woman. So he wound up married to sort of his sister-in-law once removed.
Wow.
And that was the woman that my grandfather remembered as mom, because his mother, he was about five when his mother died. I mean, because you go back even not too far back and you realize that, wow, human beings have been navigating difficult things for a very long time. And, you know, what I think those previous generations had, so that the immigrant generation, I look at what the Dutch immigrants to Western Michigan, for example, or New Jersey, what they were able to build. They sacrificially together built their Christian schools and their colleges and everything, because they looked at it and said, our lives depend on this.
This is a matter of survival. It was a clarifying thing, which I think we lack a little bit right now.
Yes.
Although maybe that's why this is happening now. Maybe there's a little bit more of that. Maybe some of us are questioning whether some of the things that we might hold dear might not survive, right? And maybe we ought to revisit some of this stuff, right?
Well, and it was that religious frame, because, you know, the Dutch immigrants, if they were going to be faithful to God, they had this little Dutch Calvinist box that, you know, now looking at it seems just one of how many other boxes were there on the shelf. There's a little Dutch Calvinist box that, shoot, they had to hit. And because, you know, if someone left the Christian Reformed Church for the Reformed Church of America, that means something went wrong.
No, they were living it, right? They were living that box. And I think this failure of transmitting the culture is difficult, because everything I dig into, it just leads you down into more. So transmitting the culture, I don't think it's an easy thing. And I'm not blaming my parents. I'm not blaming my high school. I'm not blaming my college, and certainly my own shortcomings. I don't want to blame myself too much either. Something happened. And I don't know why. But anyway, it's something
Well, I think part of it is also that the culture is now being transmitted. You know, when my grandparents grew up, there wasn't radio.
Right.
The books they read, I mean, for many years in the CRC, really, even when my father went to seminary, he needed to know Dutch because many of the books you simply had to read in Dutch.
Yep.
And now, you know, this is, you know, you can Benedict option your kids and your community, but there's the internet.
Yeah.
And in my day, there was television. In my parents' day, there was radio and newspapers. And so.
And there's college, right?
Yes. I mean, and Christian colleges right now are, you know, one of the things that I've never talked about on my channel much is just the crisis of Christian education today, because, you know, even Calvin, I don't know what's going to happen to Calvin University in the wake of what's going to happen to my denomination. They just had there was a sociology professor who, with the blessing of his CRC council, performed a same-sex marriage, and his contract was not renewed by the college because of this incident, at least partly. And a good number of the faculty wrote a letter in protest to the administration. You have a situation like this where it's really hard to know how, you know, on what, depending either what either side you're on in terms of this issue, how is this institution going to come to agreement
in a way that, I assume it's an institution that many, many, many people hold dear, right? And is threatened. It's scary, right? When you see something you love being torn apart. And I don't, we're not at the end of that. And new institutions will always come. There's some interesting stuff going on the margins of higher ed with smaller religious institutions charging less, holding, you know, being a little more narrow, right? I think there's some good stuff going on there, but, you know, it's small right now, right? The number of people who are going in that direction, I think are, you know, there aren't that many, yet, but I think it's growing and the people are excited, but then you see the institutions you love, right? That's not going to solve the problem of an institution that you love, you know, potentially being torn apart. Yeah.
And what's going on in my denomination is tiny compared, you know, you look at what's going on in the Catholic Church, because even the way our tradition was that these institutions like Christian day schools in our denomination were owned and run by parent associations, not by the church. And of course, Catholic Church parochial schools, you know, there've been big fights in the San Francisco, in the Bay Area here over, you know, teaching in Catholic schools. And what the, you know, parents, I don't want to send my kids to the public school. We're going to send them to the Catholic school. Then the Catholic school starts teaching them Catholic dogma. And they're like, hey, wait a minute. You can't do that. And of course the priests are like, it's a Catholic school.
This is how it works. Well, but then I hear other complaints. Well, the Catholic schools are too much, you know, they're basically teaching the public school norms with a little dogma thrown in,
yes.
Right? Which yeah. isn't a great solution either. Anyway, I think we're in the midst of this big change. And I think some probably very, very positive things are going to come out. And I love the Meaning Crisis community and like just this constant openness to talking across these. I just love it. I'm it's a little bit of a danger to become addicted to it. But I think, you know, there's a lot of, it's a long time before those types of conversations explode into the mainstream and, you know, and maybe some new institutions emerge or we reach a new equilibrium as a society. It just seems like we're quite a ways away from that right now.
And yeah. I would say so.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, we will. We will.
Well, I'll end the recording and, unless there's something, anything you want to
just plug. Thank you for the opportunity. It's really fun to talk about it. It's especially when you put something down on paper, it's really fun to talk about it intelligently with somebody who's read it and takes it seriously. So thank you. All right.